The Tale of the Frozen Pussy, Slipper Trip, The Million Dollar Fee. These are just a few of the strange cases and wild tales you will hear on Miami Memoirs. Join Florida attorney Louis Ress as he recounts his 6 decades of legal practice in the wilds of South Florida. So, Louis, can you tell me about any particular case that had a large fee for you that, you know, was not the normal amount of money you would normally make? Do you have any million-dollar cases?
Oh, yeah. There was a club called the Million Dollar Club, and I qualified to join it, but they wouldn't take me. But it was a self-promoting thing amongst super lawyers. They didn't want me, but I did make a $1 million fee, and I'll tell you how it happened. $1 million fees just don't happen every day. It was a strange set of facts. There was this tiki bar down in the Keys. It was at Bud and Mary's Marina on the Atlantic side of the road down in Marathon. The sign was a huge marlin hanging on a block and tackle. Maybe 30 fishing boats were docked at the marina, with their chrome tuna towers rising above the roof of the tiki bar. A concrete pedestrian bridge led out onto a platform raised above the Atlantic Ocean by about 10 feet. There were wooden columns, really large stained trees, supporting a framed roof, which was covered with palm fronds. So it looked like a big cheeky
yeah.
hut. The open bar stood alone, and it was big enough to serve over 50 people. Two bartenders worked rapidly with their sleeves rolled up, shaking the rum Mai Tais. Those were drinks with 3 different types of rum in them, and the drinks flowed. The Millennium Advertising Company was having its big bash there. They owned and leased the billboards for almost half of the state of Florida. That was big, big bucks. The Miami officers were partying along with the rest of the South Florida staff. They had come in from Naples and all of South Florida. Although there were piles of stone crab claws and iced shrimp, there was very little dining, but there was a lot of boozing, a great deal of it. It started at 11 in the morning and went on and on. Robert James, the flowered short-sleeved shirt guy, he was corpulent, he was white-skinned, red-faced, slightly balding host. And as I said, he was wearing a red flowered short-sleeved shirt. He was wearing khaki shorts and Birkenstock sandals. And he was the Southeast General Manager. He had finished pumping hands and back panning and was ready to head back to Miami, except that he was bombed. He had consumed at least 6 Mai Tais, and they each were loaded with 3 types of rum. And he was wobbling when he got up from his bar stool, and he had to be walked to his car and helped in. They were afraid to tell him not to drive. He was the regional manager. It was a good way to get fired.
Wow.
And kept their mouths shut. He drove off, heading up US 1 towards Miami. The black 4-door Mercedes 550 swayed from one side of the lane to the other. However, he made it as far as the Palmetto Expressway into Dade County. He was in the north end of the county. How he did it was amazing, but he managed. He was getting off the expressway and heading towards Miami Lakes when he veered over into the oncoming traffic lane and slammed head-on into a blue Ford. The Mercedes was doing about 50 miles an hour, with the Ford going around 30. The explosion could be heard for about a half a mile. The front end of the Ford was totally blown off and crushed into the body of the car. My client, Ernest Roberto Gomez, had been heading home from work as a maintenance man at the Killian High School. Although he had a seatbelt on, the airbag didn't fully deploy, and his skull struck and shattered the windshield. A better description was that the windshield struck and shattered Ernest's skull. Robert James was drunk. That was the manager of Millennium. His body was loose, and he was only scratched. Millennium's attorneys pleaded James no contest with a prearranged drunk driving suspended sentence and a $500 fine. A suspended sentence means it doesn't get recorded, so he didn't have to lose his license. All the mandatory punishments for drunk driving did not apply to him. Okay, it was good enough for me, because the civil side of the case allowed a no-contest plea to be interpreted as accepting responsibility for the accident. Anyhow, I was just as happy to show the photographs and prove the negligence. I couldn't get the photographs of the damages before the jury as easily as I could by proving the negligence. So I was going to seek punitive damages, which can be assessed when the defendant's behavior is willful wanton, and with utter disregard for the safety of others. And Millennium would face the same damage claim since they allowed and assisted Robert James to drive drunk. They knew he was drunk. In addition, the Tiki Bar was responsible. But they had no assets or insurance, and they were on the brink of bankruptcy, and they've since disappeared. James and Millennium never sent a get-well card or flowers or even inquired as to Ernest's injuries or his recovery. I did not like James with his white face, red nose, nor did I like his arrogant, boozing, pompous company, which I found employed no blacks, Jews, women, other than in secretarial positions, or Hispanics. They were a real good old boy company. Ernest had been taken to Palmetto General Hospital, and the neurosurgeon on call, Dr. Oviedo, inserted a 3x2-inch kidney-shaped titanium plate into the upper left part of his skull to fill the gap where the skull had been splintered. It was attached with metal staples. Ernest healed beautifully, and his skull hardly showed the scar, which was just below the hairline, and then went into the scalp area. However, it was visible, and there was a depression in the front of his skull. Ernest was having some other troubles. He had occasional dizzy spells with loss of balance. His vision was not as clear and couldn't be corrected. His memory was affected. His personality had changed. He was now quiet, soft-spoken, hesitant. He lost his zest for life. His neck and upper back were painful. He used a cane, although none had been prescribed. He hadn't been able to work, and the school had replaced him. I met with Dr. Oviedo, a short, balding, dark-complexioned, quiet man in his mid-50s, and I paid him generously for the consult. He had been on call at Palmetto General Hospital when Ernest arrived by ambulance. We talked in his small, poorly lit office. Dr. Oviedo made eye contact and didn't blink. He was direct and a bit clipped, but he gradually and begrudgingly agreed that the dizziness, loss of balance, vision, and memory problems were all related to the accident. It was like pulling teeth, but finally Dr. Oviedo assigned a 15% permanent partial disability to the body as a whole and suggested psychiatric treatment. So a few weeks later, the psychiatrist, Dr. Pearl, said that Ernest would require ongoing supportive psychiatric care and would have a 10% disability from an emotional standpoint. They both concluded that Ernest would not be able to resume his old job. Global Indemnity was an insurance company that had written Millennium's basic automobile policy, which was for $1 million. And that was the policy that covered the manager. They wouldn't even talk to us. There was a $5 million excess or additional policy coverage with a company called the Glacier Insurance Group. We filed suit, and Global had Ernest evaluated by their team of doctors, in reality, professional witnesses. These professional prostitutes make a terrific second income just by testifying time after time for the insurance companies. They always say either that the injuries didn't come as a result of the accident, they just happened to occur at that moment, or the injured party was faking and that his and her pain and disability weren't real. They say everyone makes a full recovery without any residual disability and no one needs further treatment. The court wouldn't allow you to ask how much money they made from the insurance company for whom they were testifying. It would require too much expensive paperwork. That was the court's justification for not compelling them to disclose the millions of dollars that they made by testifying for the insurance companies. It was no surprise that Global's brain specialist said that Ernest made a full recovery and had no disability. Their psychiatrist was trying to help them also. He said that Ernest was fine, but that he should avoid the stress of a trial and he should settle the case. That was to put pressure on me to get the case settled, but you'll see how it backfired. The family said that Ernest really was doing great and would like to go back to work and to please get his case resolved. But they agreed that they would leave the matter in our firm's hands. There was nothing to discuss. There were no settlement offers. It is a multi-purpose tactic. We prepared a 30-page plastic-covered book, which was cross-indexed and outlined our case, starting with the clear liability. It included pictures of the damaged vehicles, copies of the accident report, and the no-contest drunk driving plea, and continued on with a list of the medical and hospital and prescription bills that Ernest had engendered. Then the medical diagnoses, the medical reports, the disability evaluations were attached. Also, positive prints of the x-rays and photos of our client's scars and an outline of his lost past and future income, plus an outline of the damages, including his physical limitations, his need for future medical care, and its costs. In addition, we spelled out the claim for pain and suffering and his wife's claim for loss of services. We attached life expectancy tables for Ernest, and the final page showed a computation and basis for a damage claim of $3 million, which did not include the claim for punitive damages not covered under the insurance policy. Well, what happens? Why do we do this? And I'll tell you more about that later. Once this package gets into the file, the insurance company has to live with it. It shows up all the time, unless they expunge it from the file, which some of them do. And I'll tell you how you can get that corrected. Anyhow, we sent a copy to both Global, the basic insurance company, and Millennium, and we told them that we would be willing to accept the basic policy insurance of $1 million as settlement, and we would waive the punitive damage claim if they agreed to settle. We set 5 p.m. on a Friday afternoon, 1 month ahead, as a deadline. It was really a setup for a bad faith claim against Global. If Global could settle within the policy limits and they unreasonably failed to do so, it would expose them for whatever a jury might award, even though there was another excess insurance company. We expected Millennium to pressure Global to settle, and if Global failed to do so, to sue Global for both bad faith should the recovery exceed $1 million. And we were going to see $10 million. So if you take the $5 million excess and the $1 million basic, that's $6 million. We were going for $10 million, and we could collect the $10 million if we got a judgment, provided we could show bad faith, the opportunity to settle within the policy limits, which they ignored. After Global received the outline, we called them, and we wrote to them weekly to remind them of the deadline. It was coming up on a Friday. No response. Finally, the fateful Friday arrived, and I remember I sat at the phone waiting and hoping and waiting and hoping some more. It was a nervous wait. The phone never rang. No offer whatsoever. So be it. It was war. It was war. We started taking sworn statements, as did Global. It was our doctors against their doctors. I was surprised that Global's attorney did not dig very deep. They sent out young associates to take the depositions, and they generally followed a written, prepared list of standard questions. They failed to ask if our doctors had any photographs. Their doctors both said that Ernest could work without any limitation and had no disability and needed no further treatment. However, their psychiatrist, Dr. Bianco, again warned, "Mr. Gomez should avoid the stress of a trial. It would be very damaging to him from an emotional point of view. He should settle his case as soon as possible." I was in Dr. Oviedo's office. Dr. Oviedo asked me to stay for a few minutes after Global's attorneys were finished with his deposition. "Mr. Ress, I've taken a liking to you, and I know that you are trying to help Mr. Gomez and that it's not just the money, but you are dedicated. Also, you have been a gentleman with me. I generally don't like lawyers, but you seem to be different, so I decided to help you. Take a look at these." With that, Dr. Oviedo handed me a large brown envelope. It was about an inch thick. Out came 6 large color photographs showing Ernest's bloody, fractured, and splintered skull. Then the sawing process to fit in the plate. Finally, the stapling of the plate into the skull and the closing of the wound with about 50 stitches. You could see a good portion of the exposed brain. It was gut-wrenching. In fact, I had trouble controlling my stomach. "Hold it. The judge might not let these pictures into evidence, since the defense would claim that they were unnecessary and designed to inflame the jury." Dr. Oviedo was no fool. He said, "I took these photographs to protect myself should there be a malpractice claim. There often is, you know. They do accurately reflect what I found and what I did, better than any verbal description I could give. I will require their use in order to testify. I think you can get them in as part of my operative record." So in the pretrial witness exhibit list, I listed the photographs as exhibits under Dr. Oviedo's name, along with and mixed in with the office records, x-rays, MRIs, photographs, and narrative reports. It was sort of slid in there. The trial date was approaching, and Ernest was getting better and better. His family was glad to see him recover, but concerned that his case would evaporate. I met with Ernest. He was bright, charming, quite verbal, anxious to please, and looked healthy and happy. He moved smoothly. He listened. He responded and almost had a twinkle in his eye. He was just probably glad to be alive. "When can I go back to work?" he asked. The jury would not be inclined to be sympathetic to Ernest. "Ernest, you are not going to the trial. Your daughter Cynthia will sit in for you. She was 17 and as cute as could be. Mr. Gomez, I don't want you at the trial. I called his wife. I said, Mrs. Gomez, I don't want you at the trial either. Ernest looks too good. He is to stay at home. I'll try the case without him. I've never heard of that before or since. Try the case intentionally and trying the case without your client. I must have been a little nuts. But with Cynthia sitting next to me at the table inside the railing in the courtroom, I rose and spoke to the judge. The entire jury panel from which the jury would be selected was sitting in the back of the courtroom within earshot. I said, Your Honor, I wish permission to have my client Ernest Gomez excused from attending his own trial and permission to have his daughter Cynthia sit in his chair as representative so that I do not have a vacant seat next to me. Mrs. Gomez is at home with Mr. Gomez. In support of this request, I would quote from the defense psychiatrist's sworn testimony as follows. Mr. Gomez should avoid the stress of trial. It would be very damaging for him. He should settle his case as soon as possible. Your Honor, there have been no offers to settle this case. The court, Judge Patua, about 60 years old, an experienced judge in a black robe, leaned over the bench. I will allow Cynthia to sit in for her father, Ernest Gomez. We interviewed and impaneled the jury. We made our opening statements. I told the jury that we were seeking punitive damages and that I intended to show that Millennium, based on their corporate statement, could well afford to pay punitive damages of $10 million. I explained that Mr. Gomez was psychiatrically not able to attend his own trial and would never again be able to walk his daughter Cynthia down the aisle at her wedding. My voice caught in my throat. My eyes started to tear. The state trooper testified. The drunk driving, no contest agreement went into evidence. The pictures of the crash were admitted and the first day of trial was ending. The judge leans over the bench. He makes direct eye contact with me and drops his jaw. Mr. Ress, you mean that there were no offers of settlement? None, Your Honor. Judge Padua turns and stares at opposing counsel. Mr. MacArthur, is Mr. Ress accurate? No offers? MacArthur shifts his weight and seems uncomfortable and says, Sir, I have no control over the client or the insurance carrier. In fact, I represent the excess insurance carrier, Glacier Global. The primary carrier has denied coverage. Judge Padua leans over the bench and stares at Mr. MacArthur. MacArthur, go back to your client and tell them I want this case settled. Day two started with various records, and the custodians of Palmetto General Hospital came. I called the defense insurance company psychiatrist, Dr. Bianco, as an expert witness adverse to me, and I limit the area of questioning so that they can't cross-examine him beyond what I ask. I asked him to confirm that Mr. Gomez was sufficiently fragile from an emotional point of view that he should not be subject to the stress of a trial. He agrees. Jury is on the edge of their seats. Dr. Bianco leaves the courtroom and the judge calls us to the bench. This time, His Honor is leaning over out of the high desk. MacArthur, do you have any authority? No, sir. Don't you understand? He points the finger at him. I said I want this case settled and I want you to pay $2.5 million now. Your Honor, my client is only the excess carrier and they won't pay. I join in. Your Honor, this is a $10 million case. We are seeking $10 million. Oh. The judge is now riled up. You'll take it. MacArthur, tell your client to come up with it by tomorrow. I am not joking with you. The judge gets up and quickly storms out of the courtroom. I knew we had them. They couldn't flaunt the judge and not pay the price. He would allow me to introduce the assets of Millennium and to allow a charge to the jury for punitive damages. MacArthur will now have to report that a huge $10 million damage exposure exists to Glacier, as well as to Global and to Millennium. Then there will be Dr. Ovida's pictures. Judge Padua would now probably allow them into evidence. It was a decision solely within his discretion. MacArthur didn't even know that those pictures were coming at him. Judge, although this case is worth and we will seek $10 million, my client would accept $3 million plus taxable costs in an effort to cooperate with the court. The judge was clearly irritated. Don't you gentlemen listen. I said $2.5 million and I want it tendered by tomorrow at 9 o'clock, Mr. MacArthur. Your client will pay it plus costs and seek reimbursement from Global. Mr. Rest, don't you argue. Just take it. The bailiff calls the court to order. It's 9:30 in the morning. We're all standing. The judge walks rapidly to his high-backed leather chair. It's almost like a throne. Okay, Mr. MacArthur, do you have the money? Yes, sir, but only $2 million. You still don't understand me. I said 2.5 plus costs, and I meant it. Now get on the phone and get it. Now, I mean now. 5 minutes later, MacArthur's back. Judge, I have it. The judge leans forward. Mr. Ress, okay? Only if we have cleared funds within 10 days. The judge says to MacArthur, don't argue, just do it. This case is settled. Not so fast. Yes, I made a 40% contingent fee, which equals $1 million. Glacier Insurance, the excess insurance company that had laid out the settlement money, sued Global, the basic insurance company, for bad faith, for failing to tender the 1 million basic policy, which would have settled the case. MacArthur calls me as a witness, and I look at the jury, each one separately, as I told the story, including our willingness initially to accept $1 million and waiting at the phone on that Friday afternoon when no call came in. Mr. MacArthur says to me, Mr. Ress, what made you think now that this case was worth over $1 million? He knew that I had the settlement brochure at the ready. I brought it out, and I explained to the jury how it established that the case was worth $3 million, but I didn't stop there. I was looking directly at the jury, and I said, and MacArthur didn't know this was coming, Mr. MacArthur, there's something else that I learned of later and was going to be introduced in evidence that really makes the value of this case much greater. These photographs taken by the treating brain surgeon. Before Global's attorney could object, I whipped out the photographs and held them up and showed them to the jury. They gasped. You could clearly hear a unified gasp. Global's attorney stood there dumbfounded, and the pictures went into evidence. Well, the jury came out against my pals, Global, for $5,500,000. Global's attorney called about 1 month later and offered to pay me $10,000 for my expert testimony or to donate to my favorite charity the same amount. I said, no, thank you. I already had my reward. It's not over. Mrs. Gomez makes an appointment, and she comes into the office with Mr. Gomez, and she's clearly nervous. She's twisting the end of her purse strap, and her fingers continue to move over one another as she speaks. Mr. Ress, Ernest is anxious to have a full life. We are expecting another child. He doesn't wish to use the cane anymore. He wants to drive the car. He wants to engage in sports, and he wants to go back to full-time work, which would involve strenuous activity. My friends warned me that Global could have Ernest followed and try to set aside the settlement because he is so active and doing the things that he said he could not do in his sworn statement. I leaned forward and smiled at them. Mrs. Gomez, normally I would not say this, but Millennial and Global have done us both wrong. They should have been apologetic and reasonable. Millennium people are nasty. They're selfish. They're prejudiced. They're bigoted. They're drunkards. Global let me wait for a phone call that never came. You are devout Catholics. Have you ever heard of St. Anne de Beaupré? It's a church near Quebec. In fact, it's about 19 miles east on the St. Lawrence River. It's famous for its miraculous cures. You might consider a trip there. The walls are lined with crutches. It would be a good place for you to pray for a cure with a priest and leave the cane. That is the story.
That
the million dollar fee.
Well earned, too.
So, there's a lot of messages in that story about behavior. First of all, there's a big fight between the rich and the poor. There always has been a big differential in their treatment. Here's this guy from Millennial that is drunk, and everyone knows he's drunk, and he gets a head-on collision. And his lawyer gets him out with a suspended sentence and a $500 fine. Now, if you and I, or the average person, had a problem like that, the minimum fine would be $1,000. And, of course, the judge could imprison you for 6 months.
Probably lose your license.
And then sure. 50 hours of community service.
Sure.
And then, right, up to 5 years driver's license revocation. That's what you're facing, and 180 days to 1 year probation. And so there's a message there. The guy that did the worst of all was the manager, Robert James, and he gets off with nothing. I'm sure the company paid the fine for him, $500, and retained a lawyer for him. So that's terrible. Millennium gets off with little or nothing. They knew that he was driving drunk and didn't open their mouths, and they didn't have to pay anything because their insurance carrier, Global, was the one that got stuck. And of the three, Global was the least
liable,
least guilty morally, and they wind up paying a lot of money. So that's the the tipping of the scales by wealthy people who hire the right lawyers in front of the right judges and the judges who flex for the rich. So the law doesn't treat people equally.
No.
There's a lot of things going on.
But let me ask you in regards to that, how does a judge have, I mean, what's the basis for the authority for the judge to say, 2.5, you've got to take it, Mr. Ress, you got to tender it, so-and-so, and that's it. Can a judge mandate like that?
I'm glad you got into that. That was something I was going to talk about, too. In prior years, the judges had huge discretion on what they could or couldn't do. They just ran for office. They were politicians. So every 6 years or so, they had, or 4 years, they had to run for office. And no one would dare run against them because they could raise money from all the lawyers that practiced before them.
Mm.
And a lot of corporations that had business in the courts. The lawyers that practiced in front of them were afraid not to support them because when they got reelected, they'd be back in front of the judge. Nice. And they weren't on his committee and they didn't raise money. So they limited how much money a judge can collect from one person for reelection. So people get around that immediately by having corporations donate, by having every individual in the family make a donation. Every child, every sister, brother, cousin makes a donation. The income to the judge is limitless. That way you can have, if it's $5,000, you can have 50 donations coming from all sources.
Right.
Through one attorney. And that attorney serves on the judge's reelection committee. So it's, and often, particularly in matrimonial cases, which I'll talk about later, the judge awards the fee against a rich husband, and he's never going to see that rich husband before. That's only one vote, so he can stick it to him.
He can afford to do it.
Right. This also brings up bad faith litigation. I can talk to you about that a little bit. What we did here was we set up the insurance company for bad faith, which they wound up being stuck with. And it cost $4.5 million extra. And what you do is you set them up. There's a bad faith law now. It used to be common law, and then they made it statutory, where an insurance company must settle a case on a reasonable basis in a reasonable time after they're aware of it by making an offer if the liability is clear. And if they fail to do that, particularly after they're noticed to do it and the opportunity exists, then they can become responsible for any recovery that goes beyond their policy limits. And that really is a frightening thing to insurance companies and their attorneys who specialize in bad faith litigation. In a rear-end automobile accident, if you're hit in the rear and you're damaged, and let's say you have an operation to your back, and there's a $10,000 liability policy, and your attorney writes him a letter, says, we're willing to take the $10,000, says, we've got $50,000 in medical bills, and my client has a fractured spine, and they don't do it, then they can get stuck for the whole thing. So it moves a lot of the insurance companies to stop stonewalling.
Mm.
Now, talk to you about St. Anne de Beaupré. How did I know about that? Well, I had represented the Diocese of Miami for a number of years, but that's not how I learned about it. I was a tourist in Canada, and I went on a trip east of Quebec, and I ran into this beautiful chapel. It's a Catholic chapel, and it's St. Anne is the patron saint. And once a year, they have, on her birthday, I guess, they have a big celebration there. And she intercedes for people who are sick and disabled and often cures them. The story was that when they first laid the first building blocks, the guy that was laying them, putting on the cement on the blocks, had terrible arthritis all his life, and suddenly he said, I'm cured.
Huh.
And that was the first, that's how they learned that it was a curing place. So I just thought I'd tell you a little bit about it.